Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into cutting-edge research with intrigue and depth. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host, Jen.
Hi everyone. For this episode, we're going to be discussing a fascinating paper titled Two Wrongs Make One Right: The Role of Retaliatory Incivility in Conferring Social Rewards. This research really challenges the conventional wisdom about incivility and the social consequences it brings.
That's right, Jen. This paper by Merrick Osborne, Ali Amrani, Sahib Abdurrahman, Jackson Traeger, and Morteza Degani explores a surprising finding: that retaliatory incivility, rather than being disparaged, can actually be rewarded with greater social status.
The core idea here is that while incivility is generally frowned upon, there may be certain situations where it's seen as more virtuous, especially when it's in response to someone else's rude behavior. The researchers wanted to test this hypothesis and understand the mechanisms behind it.
To do this, they conducted a multi-method investigation, including an observational study on Reddit and a series of controlled experiments. Let's dive into the details.
The Reddit study was really fascinating. The researchers looked at over 2 million comments on the platform and found that uncivil responses to uncivil posts received more karma, a measure of social rewards on Reddit, compared to uncivil responses to civil posts.
In other words, when people retaliated with incivility against someone who had been rude to them first, they were granted more social status and approval than those who acted uncivilly without provocation. This suggests that there may be a perceived virtue in retaliatory incivility that leads to greater social rewards.
To further explore this idea, the researchers conducted a series of experiments. In one study, they recruited a sample of Reddit users and asked them to imagine a scenario where someone in their favorite subreddit either responded uncivilly to an uncivil post or responded uncivilly to a civil post.
Participants who witnessed the retaliatory incivility rated the uncivil responder as more virtuous, seeing their actions as more right, just, fair, and morally correct. Importantly, they also conferred more status on this retaliator, reporting that they admired them more and held them in higher regard.
The researchers then replicated these findings in the contexts of sports fans, both hockey and baseball. Even when the retaliatory incivility could potentially disadvantage the person's favorite team, participants still viewed the retaliator as more virtuous and worthy of status.
These results are quite remarkable. They suggest that there are situations where incivility is not only tolerated, but actively rewarded, challenging the dominant view that rudeness is universally condemned. The researchers propose that this may be because retaliatory incivility is seen as a form of virtuous violence, harming someone who has wronged the group.
Exactly. The moral virtue theory of status attainment argues that people can gain social status by engaging in praiseworthy behavior that goes beyond conformity to norms. In the case of retaliatory incivility, the willingness to stand up to an aggressor and defend the group's interests seems to be viewed as a virtuous act, worthy of respect and admiration.
This research has important implications for understanding the rise of global incivility. If retaliatory incivility is actually rewarded in certain contexts, it could create a vicious cycle where rude behavior begets more rude behavior, as people seek to defend themselves and their groups.
Absolutely. This study really sheds light on the complex social dynamics at play. Incivility is not just about individual transgressions. It's embedded in a web of group allegiances, perceptions of virtue, and status conferral. Understanding these nuances is crucial for developing interventions to address uncivil behavior.
Jen, this is such a thought-provoking and counterintuitive piece of research. It really challenges us to rethink our assumptions about incivility and the social rewards it can bring. I'm curious to hear your personal reflections on this study.
Well, Tom, I have to admit, I found the results quite surprising. On the one hand, I can see the logic behind the researchers' arguments, that retaliation against a perceived wrongdoer could be viewed as a virtuous act. But it's still jarring to see that incivility, even in response to incivility, can be rewarded with increased status and approval.
Agreed. It really makes you wonder about the broader societal implications. If people are incentivized to clap back or read for filth when faced with rudeness, that could perpetuate a culture of escalating incivility. At the same time, I can see how the researchers' findings align with theories about group loyalty and the acceptance of norm-violating behaviors that benefit the in-group.
Exactly. There's a fine line between standing up for oneself or one's group, and simply perpetuating a cycle of disrespect. The key, I think, lies in understanding the nuanced social contexts and perceptions that shape these dynamics. This research provides an important starting point for exploring those complexities.
Absolutely. And I think one of the strengths of this study is the multi-method approach, which allows the researchers to examine these processes across different domains, from online communities to sports fans. That kind of broad generalizability is really valuable.
Definitely. By replicating their findings in these varied contexts, the authors demonstrate the robustness of their conclusions. It's not just about Reddit or hockey. There seems to be a more universal tendency to view retaliatory incivility as virtuous, even when it comes at a cost to the in-group.
Right, and I think that's a crucial point, that people were still willing to reward the retaliator, even when their uncivil actions could disadvantage their own team or group. It speaks to the power of perceived virtue and the willingness to overlook negative consequences in service of that perception.
Absolutely. This research really highlights how complex and nuanced the social dynamics around incivility can be. It's not a simple story of incivility is always punished. There are contexts where it can be seen as justified, even admirable. And that has important implications for how we understand and address uncivil behavior in our societies.
Definitely. This paper leaves us with a lot to ponder. On the one hand, it's troubling to see how incivility can be rewarded, as that could perpetuate a cycle of escalating rudeness. But on the other hand, it also points to the importance of understanding the social relational contexts that shape these perceptions of virtue and status.
Absolutely. I think the key takeaway here is that we need to move beyond simplistic views of incivility as universally bad. The reality is much more complex, and by digging deeper into the underlying social dynamics, we may be able to find more effective ways to promote civility and respect. This study is an important step in that direction.
Well said, Jen. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I'm grateful we had the chance to explore this thought-provoking research in depth. It's a great example of how cutting-edge science can challenge our assumptions and broaden our understanding of the world around us.
I couldn't agree more, Tom. This paper on the role of retaliatory incivility in conferring social rewards is a prime example of the kind of intriguing and impactful work we love to discuss on this podcast. It really makes you think about the nuances of human behavior and the complex social factors that shape our perceptions and judgments.
Absolutely. And I think it's a great reminder that the world is rarely black and white. There are often shades of gray and unexpected dynamics at play. This research has certainly opened my eyes to that. And I'm left with a deeper appreciation for the richness and complexity of human social interactions.
Couldn't have said it better myself, Tom. This has been a truly enlightening episode, and I'm sure our listeners have come away with a much richer understanding of this fascinating area of research. Thank you all for joining us, and we look forward to uncovering more groundbreaking discoveries in the episodes to come.
Thanks everyone, and we'll see you next time. Upbeat jingle plays. Are you tired of the daily grind and uninspiring social rewards?
Introducing Righteous Retorts, the one-stop shop for all your retaliatory incivility needs.
When someone crosses the line, don't just take it lying down. Strike back with the perfect cutting comeback, guaranteed to boost your social status.
Our team of expert insult crafters will custom design the most virtuous, morally justified putdowns, tailored to your specific situation.
Whether it's dealing with rude coworkers, obnoxious neighbors, or trolls on the internet, Righteous Retorts has your back.
With our easy-to-use online platform, you can quickly select from a menu of scathing retorts or work with our writers to concoct the perfect retaliatory zinger.
And the best part? The more scorching your response, the more social rewards you'll receive. It's science.
So what are you waiting for? Log on to RighteousRetorts.com and start earning the respect you deserve, one epic clapback at a time.
Righteous Retorts, because two wrongs really do make a right. Jingle repeats and fades out. Intro. Welcome to the Informed Insight Podcast. I'm your host, Tom.
And I'm your co-host, Jen. On our show, we dive deep into the latest cutting-edge research, uncovering insights that can transform how we understand the world around us.
Today, we have a truly fascinating paper to discuss. It's titled A Conversation on Indigenous Healing and Joy in an Urban Indigenous Landscape, and it's authored by the Indigenous Joy Collective, a group of six Indigenous healers from various organizations in Minneapolis-St. Paul.
This paper is a powerful exploration of indigenous joy and its role in healing and wellness, set against the backdrop of the urban indigenous community in Minneapolis-St. Paul. It's a captivating blend of personal narratives, cultural context, and implications for the future.
The authors weave together their diverse experiences to paint a vivid picture of what indigenous joy looks like and how it can foster collective healing, even in the face of historical trauma and ongoing challenges. This is a story of resilience, resistance, and the transformative power of joy.
Let's dive right in and learn more about this fascinating research. Where do we begin, Tom? Body.
Well, Jen, the authors start by situating their discussion within the context of the urban indigenous community in Minneapolis-St. Paul. As they explain, this region is home to over 35,000 indigenous people, due in part to the Federal Indian Relocation Act of 1956.
That act coerced indigenous peoples to move from reservations to cities, with the goal of assimilating them into mainstream American society. But instead of wiping out indigenous cultures, the authors say this policy actually fueled the creation of a thriving, diverse urban indigenous landscape.
Absolutely. The authors highlight how this urban setting has become a site of indigenous resistance, survivance, and joy. They point to the founding of the American Indian Movement, the establishment of indigenous-led schools and housing complexes, and the active presence of indigenous peoples as evidence of this.
It's such an interesting juxtaposition. The urban environment was intended to erase indigenous identity, but instead it's become a place where indigenous peoples have transformed it into a hub of cultural vitality and collective healing.
Exactly. The authors then convene what they call the Indigenous Joy Collective, six indigenous healers from various organizations in Minneapolis-St. Paul. Through a talking circle format, they delve into the meaning of indigenous joy and how it manifests in their personal and professional lives.
One of the key themes that emerges is the idea of indigenous joy as a deeply relational, somatic experience. As one participant, Lyle, describes it, "You know it when you see it. You feel it, it's in your felt sense, it's in your bones, it's in your blood memory."
The authors talk about how joy is intimately tied to their ancestral connections, their cultural traditions and ceremonies, and the experience of being in community with other indigenous peoples. It's not just a fleeting emotion, but a profound, embodied sense of belonging and resilience.
And the ways they describe experiencing joy in their work are so powerful. Ashley, for example, talks about the joy she sees in her clients when they learn traditional skills like beading or sewing, and how that helps foster their own healing and recovery.
Absolutely. The authors also highlight how their urban context, while presenting challenges, also enables certain opportunities for cultivating joy. Things like the diversity of indigenous cultures represented, the ability to access ceremonies and traditions, and the power of grassroots activism all contribute to an environment where joy can thrive.
It's really a testament to the resilience and brilliance of indigenous peoples, Tom. Rather than being defeated by the forces of colonization and displacement, they've transformed the urban landscape into a place of collective healing and celebration of their cultures.
Definitely. And the authors don't shy away from discussing the negative impacts of the urban environment as well. They talk about the overt discrimination, systemic racism, and historical trauma that indigenous peoples continue to face, and how that can create barriers to joy.
But even in the face of those immense challenges, the authors emphasize the importance of focusing on the positive, the marches, the ceremonies, the laughter and humor that sustain their communities. As Anthony says, "We're not going to let you forget what's going on, we're going to keep it in your face."
That's such a powerful sentiment. The authors are really asserting the right of indigenous peoples to exist, resist, and persist in the face of ongoing oppression. And they see indigenous joy as an integral part of that resistance and path to justice.
Absolutely. The authors conclude the paper by offering recommendations for how readers, both indigenous and non-indigenous, can support the vitality and wellness of urban indigenous communities. Things like attending indigenous-led events, donating to indigenous organizations, and prioritizing environmental justice.
It's a compelling call to action, Jen. This paper really highlights the incredible resilience and brilliance of indigenous peoples, and the transformative power of joy in the face of adversity. It's a must-read for anyone interested in indigenous studies, urban sociology, or the healing potential of community, Reflections.
This paper was just so rich and multifaceted, Tom. I was really struck by the author's insistence on centering joy and collective healing, rather than the typical deficit-based narratives we so often see in research on indigenous communities.
Definitely. The way they wove together personal stories, cultural context, and implications for the future was just masterful. It really drives home the point that Indigenous joy is not just a fleeting emotion, but a profound, embodied experience that is intimately tied to identity, community, and resistance.
Absolutely. And I loved how they refused to provide a single, static definition of Indigenous joy. Instead, they allowed the concept to emerge organically through the diverse voices and perspectives of the Indigenous Joy Collective. It speaks to the inherent diversity and dynamism of these lived experiences.
Yes, that was such a brilliant move on their part. By eschewing a top-down, academic framing, they were able to capture the richness and complexity of Indigenous joy in a way that feels authentic and true to the communities they're representing.
And I really appreciated their emphasis on the urban context, Tom. So often, discussions of Indigenous communities tend to focus on reservations or rural areas. But this paper shows how the unique challenges and opportunities of the city can actually foster profound acts of resilience and collective healing.
Definitely. It challenges the notion that Indigenous peoples are somehow out of place or disconnected in urban settings. Instead, the authors demonstrate how Indigenous peoples have strategically transformed these spaces into sites of resistance and joy.
Absolutely. And I found their recommendations for supporting urban Indigenous communities to be so thoughtful and practical. Things like attending Indigenous-led events, donating to organizations, and prioritizing environmental justice, these are tangible ways that readers can get involved.
Agreed. This paper really emphasizes the importance of non-Indigenous people showing up as true accomplices and allies, rather than just passive observers or well-meaning but ineffective supporters.
Exactly. Overall, this was such a powerful and inspiring read, Tom. It challenges us to rethink our assumptions about Indigenous communities, to celebrate their resilience and brilliance, and to consider how we can all play a role in supporting their self-determined visions of health and wellness. Conclusion.
Absolutely, Jen. This paper is a testament to the enduring strength and spirit of Indigenous peoples, and a roadmap for how we can all work towards a more just and joyful future.
Perfectly said, Tom. This conversation on Indigenous healing and joy in an urban setting is a must-listen for anyone interested in understanding the richness and complexity of Indigenous experiences. It's a powerful reminder that joy, in the face of adversity, is an act of resilience and justice.
Couldn't agree more, Jen. Thank you all for joining us on this exploration of Indigenous joy and healing. We hope this episode has inspired you to seek out more opportunities to learn from and support Indigenous communities in your own lives and communities.
Absolutely. Until next time, keep seeking out those informative insights that can transform how we see the world. Thanks for listening.
Commercial. Are you tired of feeling disconnected from your ancestral roots? Longing for a deeper sense of community and belonging?
Introducing Dimension Shifters, the interdimensional travel agency designed to reconnect you with your Indigenous heritage.
That's right, with our state-of-the-art dimensional portals, you can explore the vibrant, joy-filled landscapes of your ancestors. Experience the traditions, ceremonies, and connections that will nourish your soul.
From the bustling urban centers to the remote wilderness, our Indigenous tour guides will transport you to otherworldly realms where you can reclaim your cultural identity and unlock the healing power of joy.
So what are you waiting for? Book your journey with Dimension Shifters today and discover the interdimensional magic that awaits.
Dimension Shifters, bridging the gap between worlds, one adventure at a time.
Hello and welcome to our podcast. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host, Jen.
Hi there, listeners. Today, we're excited to dive into a fascinating research paper that explores the multiple paths to sentence interpretation. This is a topic that's crucial for understanding how our brains make sense of the language we hear and read every day.
The paper we'll be discussing is titled Multiple Paths to Sentence Interpretation: Case Studies of Older Adults and Persons with Aphasia, and it was authored by Malathi Thothathiri from the Department of Speech, Language and Hearing Sciences at the George Washington University.
The central idea of this paper is that there isn't just one way our brains process sentences. Instead, individuals can take different paths to arrive at the same ultimate understanding of a sentence. And this variability in sentence processing can be seen even in people who don't have any obvious language difficulties.
That's right. The researchers tested two groups, neurotypical older adults and individuals with aphasia who had good sentence comprehension. And what they found was that even within these groups, there were differences in how the participants went about interpreting the sentences they heard.
This is such an important finding because it challenges the common assumption that people with aphasia, or even older adults, necessarily rely more on semantic cues rather than syntactic ones when trying to understand sentences. The reality seems to be much more complex.
Exactly. To really dive into this, the researchers used a combination of eye tracking and behavioral measures. They had the participants listen to sentences that were semantically implausible, like the cop was handcuffed by the robber, and then look at pictures that either matched the syntax or the semantics of the sentence.
And what they found was fascinating. Even though all the participants were highly accurate in comprehending the sentences, the eye tracking data revealed distinct differences in how they were processing the information. Some were focusing more on the syntactic cues, while others seemed to be relying more on the semantic plausibility.
Right, and importantly, these differences weren't just seen between the two groups, neurotypical older adults and people with aphasia. They were also observed within each group. So there was variability not just across different populations, but also among individuals within the same population.
That's a really important point. The researchers didn't just find group-level differences, but also individual-level differences. And they suggest that this variability in processing paths is actually normal, it's not just something we see in people with language impairments.
Absolutely. The authors argue that we need to be careful not to conflate comprehension outcomes with the actual processing paths that people take to arrive at those outcomes. Just because two people end up with the same level of sentence understanding, it doesn't mean they got there in the same way.
That's a really valuable insight. And it has important implications, both for our theoretical understanding of sentence processing and for clinical approaches to treating language disorders.
Definitely. On the theoretical side, these findings challenge the notion that there's a single, universal model of sentence comprehension. Instead, they suggest that people can employ a variety of strategies and cues, and take different routes to arrive at the same destination.
And from a clinical perspective, the authors argue that this variability in processing paths means we need to be more attentive to individual differences when working with people with aphasia. A one-size-fits-all approach to treatment may not be effective, and we may need to tailor our interventions to the specific strengths and weaknesses of each individual.
That's a really important point. By using techniques like eye tracking, we can gain a deeper understanding of how each person is approaching sentence comprehension. And that can help us develop more personalized and effective treatment plans.
Absolutely. This study really highlights the value of looking at individual differences, rather than just relying on group-level analyses. It's a great reminder that the brain is endlessly complex and adaptable, and that there's often more than one way to arrive at the same outcome.
Well said, Jen. This was a really fascinating paper, and I think it has important implications for our understanding of language processing and the treatment of language disorders. It's a great example of how cutting-edge research can shed new light on age-old questions.
Definitely. And I think it also speaks to the power of using multifaceted, multimodal approaches like eye tracking in addition to traditional behavioral measures. That combination of methods can really give us a richer and more nuanced picture of what's going on in the brain.
Absolutely. This is the kind of research that I find just so captivating. It really challenges our assumptions and pushes us to think in new ways about these fundamental cognitive processes. I can't wait to see where this line of inquiry leads next.
Me too, Tom. This was a fantastic deep dive into a really thought-provoking paper. I'm sure our listeners have gotten a lot to ponder from this discussion. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just that I'm really grateful to the researchers for this work, and I hope it inspires others to continue exploring the amazing complexity of the human mind. There's always more to discover, and studies like this one are essential for advancing our understanding.
Beautifully said, Tom. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you all for joining us, and we'll see you next time on the podcast.
Take care, everyone. Are you tired of your brain always taking the same old path to sentence interpretation? Well, have we got the product for you. Introducing
Pathfinder, the revolutionary brain enhancement system that helps you explore new routes to understanding language.
With Pathfinder, you can train your brain to take the road less traveled when it comes to processing sentences. No more relying on the same old semantic and syntactic cues.
Pathfinder uses cutting-edge neurotechnology to stimulate new neural pathways in your brain. It's like having a personal GPS for your language comprehension.
Simply strap on the Pathfinder headset and let the gentle electrical pulses guide your brain down unexpected interpretive avenues. Semantic who? Syntax what?
Unleash the full versatility of your sentence processing prowess with Pathfinder. Available now for the low price of 3 easy payments of $19.95.
Don't settle for a one-track mind. Expand your cognitive horizons with Pathfinder. The future of flexible language processing is here.
Pathfinder, because your brain deserves more than just a single route to understanding. Order now.
Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the cutting-edge research shaping the future. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host, Jen.
Hello everyone. Today, we're excited to unpack a fascinating paper that tackles a critical challenge in the world of large language models. The title of the paper is Reducing Hallucinations in Large Language Models Through Contextual Position Encoding.
Ah, yes, this is a topic that's been on the minds of many researchers and AI enthusiasts. Large language models, or LLMs, have made incredible strides in natural language processing, but as they've become more sophisticated, they've also grappled with a persistent problem, hallucinations.
Exactly, Tom. Hallucinations occur when these powerful models generate content that is factually incorrect or completely fabricated. This can be a serious issue, especially in applications that require a high degree of accuracy, like healthcare, legal, or educational domains.
The researchers behind this paper, Sarah De Rochers, James Wilson, and Matthew Beauchene, recognize the need to address this challenge. Their proposed solution is a novel technique called contextual position encoding, or CPE for short.
CPE is an innovative approach that aims to enhance the positional awareness of LLMs, helping them maintain better contextual coherence and factual consistency throughout their generative process. Let's dive into the details of how they implemented this and the impressive results they achieved.
The researchers started by integrating CPE into Mistral Large, a state-of-the-art LLM. Traditionally, language models have relied on fixed or learned positional embeddings to provide information about the order of tokens in a sequence. However, these methods can fall short when it comes to maintaining context over longer stretches of text.
CPE takes a more sophisticated approach. Instead of using static positional encodings, the model dynamically encodes positional information based on the context of each token. This allows the model to better understand the relationships between tokens, even in extended passages, and reduces the likelihood of generating hallucinatory content.
The researchers conducted a comprehensive evaluation of the impact of CPE on Mistral Large's performance. They measured precision, recall, and F1 score, key metrics that capture the model's ability to generate accurate and coherent text.
The results were quite remarkable. The integration of CPE led to significant improvements across all of these metrics, demonstrating the effectiveness of this novel positional encoding technique. Importantly, the researchers also observed a substantial reduction in hallucination rates, further validating the benefits of CPE.
But the researchers didn't stop there. They also conducted a comparative analysis, pitting Mistral Large with CPE against baseline models like GPT-3 and BERT. The findings confirmed the superiority of the CPE-enhanced architecture, highlighting its potential to shape the future development of LLMs.
This is a really exciting breakthrough, Tom. By addressing the hallucination issue, the researchers have made a crucial step towards improving the reliability and trustworthiness of large language models. Imagine how this could transform the way we use these powerful AI systems in high-stakes domains.
Absolutely, Jen. The implications are far-reaching. With CPE, we could see LLMs become more reliable assistants in healthcare, where accurate information is paramount. They could be used to generate legal documents with greater confidence. And in education, these models could provide more trustworthy learning resources.
You know, what I found particularly fascinating about this research is how it highlights the importance of positional encoding in language models. It's easy to overlook these seemingly minor architectural details, but as this paper demonstrates, they can have a profound impact on a model's performance and real-world applicability.
You're right, Jen. The researchers didn't just stumble upon a quick fix. They delved into the nuances of position encoding and recognized the need for a more sophisticated approach. Their work really underscores the value of fundamental research and how it can lead to transformative breakthroughs.
Exactly. This study not only provides a practical solution to the hallucination problem, but it also contributes to our broader understanding of how language models work and where we can focus our efforts to improve them further. It's a testament to the power of rigorous scientific inquiry.
Absolutely. This is the kind of research that gets us excited about the future of natural language processing and the potential of AI to tackle complex challenges. I can't wait to see how contextual position encoding and other innovative techniques continue to shape the development of large language models.
Me too, Tom. This has been a fascinating dive into a critical aspect of LLM research. I'm sure our listeners have gained a deeper appreciation for the nuances and complexities involved in creating these powerful AI systems. Thank you all for joining us today. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone. Keep exploring the frontiers of science with us. Jingle plays.
Are you tired of those pesky hallucinations ruining your language model experience?
Introducing Contextual Clarity, the revolutionary position encoding solution that banishes hallucinations for good.
With Contextual Clarity, your language model will stay grounded in reality, generating factual and coherent text every time.
No more fantasizing about unicorns teaching English. Contextual Clarity keeps your model firmly rooted in the here and now.
Stop hallucinating and start communicating with confidence. Get Contextual Clarity today.
Contextual Clarity, keeping your language models honest, one position at a time. Jingle plays and fades out.
Contextual Clarity, the cure for your model's delusions.
Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the latest groundbreaking research. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host, Jen.
Hello, everyone. Today, we'll be exploring a fascinating paper that looks at how cognitive and neurodevelopmental disorders fit into dimensional models of psychopathology. The paper is titled "Where Do Cognitive and Neurodevelopmental Disorders Fit in Dimensional Models of Psychopathology?" and is written by Miriam K. Forbes from Macquarie University in Australia.
This study tackles a really important question in the field of psychology and psychiatry. Traditional diagnostic systems, like the DSM, have often treated cognitive and neurodevelopmental disorders as separate from other mental health conditions. But this paper suggests that these domains may actually be better understood within a dimensional framework of psychopathology.
That's right, Tom. The paper argues that dimensional models, like the hierarchical taxonomy of psychopathology, HITOP, could provide a more nuanced and comprehensive way of understanding the relationships between cognitive, neurodevelopmental, and other mental health problems. Let's dive in and explore the details of this research.
The central question the paper addresses is whether cognitive and neurodevelopmental disorders can and should be incorporated into dimensional models of psychopathology. Now, the author, Miriam Forbes, acknowledges that these domains are often left out of the studies that inform models like HITOP, simply because they're not being assessed. But she believes this is an important oversight that needs to be addressed.
Absolutely. Forbes argues that dimensional diagnosis can, in fact, already be applied to cognitive and neurodevelopmental disorders. She points out that even the categorical DSM recognizes the dimensional nature of these conditions, with things like autism spectrum disorder being assessed dimensionally and the inclusion of severity levels for neurocognitive disorders.
That's a really interesting point. The paper suggests that there's no strong evidence for clear categorical distinctions when it comes to cognitive and neurodevelopmental functioning. Instead, these domains seem to exist on a continuum, just like many other mental health problems.
Right, and Forbes acknowledges that incorporating these domains into a psychopathology model raises some tricky questions. After all, we don't want to pathologize normal variation in human experience. But she argues that a dimensional approach can actually reduce stigma by removing the rigid boundaries between normal and abnormal.
That's a really important consideration. The paper emphasizes the need to engage with the perspectives of people with lived experience of cognitive and neurodevelopmental disorders. We need to understand how they would want these domains to be represented in a classification system, and how to ensure that it facilitates access to supportive care without stigmatizing their experiences.
Absolutely. The paper then goes on to explore some of the specific challenges in trying to fit cognitive and neurodevelopmental disorders into a model like HITOP. For example, HITOP doesn't currently incorporate things like age of onset or cause of illness, which are key features of these types of disorders.
That's a really good point. The paper suggests that to fully integrate these domains, HITOP would need to be expanded to include factors like age of onset, standardized testing, known etiologies, and functional impairment. This is a tall order and might require a more complex hierarchical model to properly capture the nuances of cognitive and neurodevelopmental problems.
The paper then presents some fascinating new data from a study led by Forbes and her colleagues. They analyzed self-reported symptoms from over 14,000 individuals and found that a novel neurodevelopmental and cognitive difficulties spectrum emerged from the data.
This is really intriguing. The study identified two main branches under this new spectrum: neurodevelopmental difficulties, which included things like social communication problems and altered sensation, and cognitive difficulties, which encompassed issues like neurocognitive impairment and forgetfulness.
What's really interesting is how these new dimensions seem to map onto the symptoms of well-known neurodevelopmental and cognitive disorders, like autism spectrum disorder and ADHD. The paper includes some great visualizations that show how the DSM defines symptoms for these conditions split across the different dimensions.
Absolutely. The paper suggests that this kind of empirical, data-driven approach could help us better understand the relationships between cognitive, neurodevelopmental, and other mental health problems. It raises the possibility that symptoms traditionally associated with certain disorders might actually be better understood as part of transdiagnostic dimensions.
That's a really exciting implication. The paper also highlights how this more inclusive modeling of symptoms could have broader implications for our understanding of psychopathology as a whole. It suggests that things like cognitive symptoms from somatoform disorders or distractibility from externalizing disorders might actually be better captured by these new neurodevelopmental and cognitive difficulties dimensions.
Wow, that's a really fascinating finding. It really speaks to the potential of taking a more holistic, dimensional approach to understanding the full spectrum of human experience, rather than trying to fit everything neatly into traditional diagnostic boxes.
Exactly. The paper acknowledges that this is just one study, and more research is certainly needed to replicate and further explore these patterns. But it offers a really compelling perspective on how we might be able to better integrate cognitive and neurodevelopmental domains into dimensional models of psychopathology.
Absolutely. This is such an important area of research, with real-world implications for how we conceptualize, diagnose, and treat mental health conditions. I'm really excited to see where this line of inquiry goes in the future, and how it might transform our understanding of the human mind and experience.
Me too, Tom. This paper is a great example of the kind of cutting-edge, interdisciplinary research that we love to spotlight on this podcast. It really challenges us to think beyond traditional boundaries and consider new ways of understanding the complexities of the human condition. I can't wait to see what other fascinating discoveries emerge from this field.
Well said, Jen. This has been a truly enlightening discussion, and I'm sure our listeners have gained a deeper appreciation for the nuances of how cognitive and neurodevelopmental disorders fit into dimensional models of psychopathology. Thank you all for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, everyone. Until next time, keep exploring the fascinating world of research with us.
In a cheery, announcer-like voice, are you feeling a bit different? Do you find yourself struggling with cognitive or neurodevelopmental challenges that just don't seem to fit neatly into any box?
With an enthusiastic tone, well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing Diamond Scions, the revolutionary new line of emotional well-being gadgets designed to support your unique spectrum of experiences.
Speaking quickly, Diamond Scions uses cutting-edge dimensional modeling technology to provide customized support for all your cognitive, social, and neurological needs. From our patented hyper-focus hats to our sensory-soothing spheres, we've got the tools to help you thrive.
Excitedly, and the best part? Diamond Scions gadgets are clinically proven to optimize your position on the psychopathology continuum. No more labels, just pure, dimensional well-being.
In a serious tone, so don't settle for one-size-fits-all mental health solutions. Embrace your unique spectrum with Diamond Scions. Available now at your local interdimensional retailer.
Cheerfully, Diamond Scions, because you're more than just a disorder. You're a whole dimensional being.